In the first hour today, we will return to a topic we certainly have discussed quite a bit since the 11th of September 2001, and that's civil liberties. And civil liberties and what's happening with them during this thing that we have come to call the war on terrorism. And on the program today, we'll be concentrating mostly on the issue of civil liberties for non-citizens, because there has been a very significant difference in the way that we think about the rights of citizens and non-citizens. Some people might be prepared to argue that non-citizens don't deserve the same constitutional protections that citizens are entitled to. Others would make the argument that no, in fact, everyone living in the United States deserves the same constitutional protections, and in fact, the freedoms, the rights of citizens, do indeed rely on, are connected to, the way that we think about the rights of non-citizens. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is David Cole. He's professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He's also a volunteer staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He is a legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, has been a commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. He is the author of a recently published book that covers this subject, and if you're interested in reading in depth, you should look for the book. It's titled Enemy Aliens. The subtitle is Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. It's published by the New Press. So the book is out there in bookstores if you're interested in looking at it. Of course, here on the program, we encourage people to call in with questions. We only ask people to try to be brief so that we could keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Cole, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Good. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks
appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
I guess maybe for the record, as they say in the CBC, it would be a good thing to start out talking about numbers a little bit, about the numbers of people, foreign, that is, non-citizens, foreign nationals, who have been detained under the umbrella of the war on terrorism.
Sure. Well, you know, the government has been a little reluctant to give out a total number. It was giving us total numbers almost on a daily basis in the initial aftermath of September 11th. Every time John Ashcroft made a speech, he would say, you know, we've now arrested 200 suspected terrorists, and we've now arrested 400 suspected terrorists. We've now arrested 800 suspected terrorists. But in early November, when the number went over 1,000 people arrested, people started asking questions, and they said, you know, how many of these 1,000 people have actually been charged with any terrorist crime? How many have been charged with 9/11? And the answer to both questions was zero, because the only person who, at that time, who'd been charged with either 9/11 or a terrorist crime was Zacharias Moussaoui, and he, of course, was picked up before this preventive detention campaign began in the wake of 9/11. And so the government on November 5th announced that it was just too difficult to continue to give out a cumulative number of how many people it had arrested in the name of the 9/11 investigation or preventing the next act of terrorism. But at that point, the last number was 1182. And so many news reporters have sort of fixed on a number of 1,200, but of course that's only the first 7 weeks of the campaign. It's not as if they stopped arresting people after 7 weeks, it's just that they stopped giving out a cumulative total. Mm. What I did in my book was to put together that total plus some other figures that the government has disclosed about detentions in anti-terrorism initiatives, and I come up with over 5,000 that the government admits it has detained, 5,000 foreign nationals, that it admits it has detained in anti-terrorism measures since September 11th. And of those 5,000, if you ask how many at this point, 2 years later, more than 2 years later, have been charged with any crime related to terrorism, the answer is three. And if you then ask, well, what happened to those three? Two of those three were acquitted of all the terrorism charges, and only one was convicted of the terrorism charges. So you've got 5,000 people locked up, you know, supposedly on the theory that these are suspected terrorists, but only three can even be charged with anything related to terrorism, and only one convicted. That's a pretty bad batting average.
And does this include those people who are held at in Guantanamo Bay?
No, and that does not. That this is only the domestic detainees. If you include the Guantanamo people, that's another about 740 or so that have been held there at one point or another. You know, so you'd then be getting close to 6,000.
I think that we people, I imagine, probably don't have a real strong grasp on the rights to which they're entitled under the Constitution
right.
and the Bill of Rights, but I guess that people do have this basic idea that if you're picked up by the police, they can only hold you for so long before they charge you. They have to tell you what they're charged with.
Right.
They have to offer you, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to an attorney if you don't. If you can't afford one, one will be provided. You know, we sort of know the speech. Have any of these people been granted those privileges?
Some of them have. Those that have been charged with criminal violations, they have to be accorded the rights, which include the right to be brought before a judge within 48 hours of arrest, the right not to be arrested without probable cause of criminal activity, the right to a public trial, etc. But that's a small number of the over 5,000. Most of these over 5,000 people, foreign nationals, have been detained under immigration authority. And the government changed the rules right after 9/11 to say that we don't have to charge people within 24 hours of arrest, within 48 hours of arrest. All we have to do is charge them within a reasonable period of arrest. Where there is a national security crisis or where there's some sort of an emergency. And they then relied on that to pick up aliens, you know, across the country and hold them without any charges whatsoever. So you're picked up, you're locked up, you're not told why you're being held. And ultimately people did get charged, but in some instances they sat in jail for 2, 3, 4 weeks with no charge whatsoever. In addition, these arrests were secret. You know, ordinarily, an arrest is a public fact, and if someone gets arrested, you know, they're entitled to make a phone call to their family, to a lawyer, to what have you. Here, the arrests were secret. So, if your husband didn't come home that night, and you called the FBI, the INS, or the local police, and said, you know, do you have any record of my husband? The answer would be no. Even if the guy was sitting, you know, right behind the officer in a prison cell, because the arrests were entirely secret, and the government imposed a communications blackout on the arrestees, meaning that they were not allowed to make calls out to family, to lawyers, etc. And that's remarkable that we were doing that, but that could, you know, in some sense that could not be done to citizens, could not be done through the criminal process, but it was done to foreign nationals through the immigration process.
There also seems to be, at least a little difficult for me to understand, and some confusion the way the government has talked about how they classify people when they're talking
right.
about or moving to the point of actually charging with somebody and going to trial. And it doesn't really seem to matter whether people are citizens or not, as we have very different situations with people like the man who was the man who was called the shoe bomber, who was charged with what seemed like an act of terrorism, but the decision there was made to give him a criminal trial. He wasn't a citizen, but then you have people like Jose Padilla or John Walker Lind,
right.
who were citizens, but whose situation was very different, where they're designated something like enemy combatants, and there it seems that a completely different set of rules applies, and it doesn't seem to be clear how it is that the decision is made that you're going to, if you have somebody and you're going to charge them and you're going to try them, how it is you're going to think about them, the nature of their crime, and then the process that you're going to go through.
Right. Well, the government has a number of options. It has more options if you're a foreign national. I guess it has probable cause to believe that you've engaged in criminal activity, it can arrest you on that probable cause, and it can indict you, and if it can prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, it can put you in, you know, it can incarcerate you as a punishment. If it lacks probable cause, and for virtually all of these people who were quote-unquote suspected terrorists and detained as suspected terrorists, the government had no probable cause. That's why they didn't get charged with anything related to terrorism. They had no probable cause of terrorism. I mean, the Inspector General of the Justice Department issued a report in June in which it looked at the people who had been picked up and held on immigration charges after 9/11, and it found that people got picked up, on incredibly slim reads of information, including, just as one example, the FBI received an anonymous tip that there were too many Muslims working in a convenience store. So they send an agent down to the convenience store and arrest the Muslims working in the convenience store. There's no evidence that these guys have any connection to 9/11, no evidence that they have any connection to Al-Qaeda, but they're arrested, thrown in detention, and then the government looks around for something to charge them with. So where the government lacks probable cause of terrorist activity, probable cause of criminal activity, it then looks for other options. One option is immigration. If the person is a foreign national, they may be able to come up with some technical immigration rule that the person has violated. So in some instances, people were charged with having failed to file a notice of change of address form within 10 days of moving. Under federal law, foreign nationals are required to notify the INS within 10 days of moving of their change of address. Now, you know, that's never been enforced before, but it became a ground for deportation and detention after 9/11 because it was a handy pretext that could be used against many people because many people didn't even know that they had to do this. If they don't have any immigration violation that can be found or charged or alleged, then the government might declare them a material witness. Because to declare someone a material witness, you don't have to show that they've engaged in any criminal activity or that you have any probable cause of crime. You just have to show that they might have information relevant to the investigation, and that if you serve them with a subpoena, which is the ordinary way that you ask someone to testify where they might have evidence relevant to an investigation, they might flee. Some 50 people were held as material witnesses in the course of this. And then if that doesn't work, then you can declare the ultimate sort of power the government has is to declare someone an enemy combatant, which the government has done with respect to all the people in Guantanamo and with respect to three people in the United States: Jose Padilla, the man arrested at O'Hare Airport and suspected of being involved in a radiological bomb conspiracy; Yasser Hamdi, an American citizen allegedly picked up in Afghanistan, later found to be a U.S. citizen, and then a man named Almari, who was being tried on a credit card fraud charge, and instead of pleading guilty, he insisted on going to trial, and so the government responded by declaring him an enemy combatant on the eve of trial and taking him out of the criminal justice system. And if you're declared an enemy combatant, the government's position is you can be locked up permanently, without charge, without a hearing, incommunicado, without access to courts, without access to a lawyer, simply because the president has designated you an enemy combatant, or as President Bush puts it more colloquially, a bad guy. And what you see in this kind of progression is that measures that were initially taken against foreign nationals, including this enemy combatant authority, the material witness authority, have now been extended to U.S. citizens. And so, when you opened this program, you talked about, this is a program about the rights of foreign nationals, but that is certainly a deep and abiding concern of mine, but one of the principal points I make in my book is that what history shows and what the current situation shows is that what the government does to foreign nationals in the name of security is a precursor for what it will do to citizens. The government officials grow accustomed to exercising broad authorities that they introduce against foreigners and on the argument that foreigners are the threat and foreigners don't have the same rights that we do. But inevitably, they seek to extend them to U.S. citizens. And so all of our rights are really at stake in the measures that the government takes against foreigners.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Cole. He's professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center, and he is the author of a book that explores this territory. And if you are interested in reading more about it in greater depth than we can do here on this program, you should look for the book. It's titled Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism, and it's published by the New Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to start us off, someone local on line number one. Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
The Patriot Act increases the government's ability and authority to tap people's phones and do these sneak and peek searches where they go into someone's home. And they don't even tell them afterwards. And I've heard that the Patriot 2, this proposed Patriot 2 Act, is supposed to go even farther than that, and allow the government even more authority to do more things that are more invasive like that. And John Ashcroft's argument for it has been that, well, he hasn't even used it. John Ashcroft has said I haven't used the authority under the Patriot Act, so we shouldn't be worried about it. He has said that we should not be worried about Patriot 2 because he has not used the authority under the Patriot Act. So why should American citizens be worried about Patriot 2 if John Ashcroft has not even used the authority under Patriot 1?
Okay, well, good question. I mean, first, he hasn't quite said that he hasn't used the authority under Patriot 1. He has said that he hasn't used one specific provision under Patriot 1, which is the Section 215, which gives the government the ability to get any business records on anyone simply by saying that it's relevant to a foreign intelligence investigation. And that would apply to library records, to bookstore records, to video store records, medical records. All these records could be obtained, and the government need not show probable cause, need not show that there's an ongoing criminal investigation, need not show that the person whose records are being sought is, in fact, a target of either a foreign intelligence or a criminal investigation. Very, very sweeping authority. And it's been under substantial attack by principally by librarians and bookstore owners who have organized very effectively and educated the public about this sweeping provision. And John Ashcroft recently declassified some information which he previously said could not possibly be shared with the country without bringing down the national security, to tell us that, in fact, they had not yet used that section, Section 215. But that's just one section of the Patriot Act. Many of the sections of the Patriot Act the government has used. And indeed, John Ashcroft argues in his speeches and on his website, lifeandliberty.gov, that the Patriot Act has been critical to fighting the war on terrorism. I think the case he makes for that is very, very weak. I think, you know, he is really not able to point to any prosecutions since 9/11 that would not have been possible before the Patriot Act. I mean, for example, one of the cases he trumpets is the Lackawanna case. The young men in Lackawanna have now pled guilty to having gone over to Afghanistan and trained in an Al-Qaeda training camp. We knew about them before the Patriot Act was enacted. They were under surveillance before the Patriot Act was enacted. They continued to be under surveillance after the Patriot Act was enacted. They never took any steps whatsoever to further any kind of terrorist activity upon returning to the United States. For all we know, they had no interest in ever engaging in any kind of illegal activity. And yet the government brought charges against them and obtained guilty pleas from them. John Ashcroft points to that as a victory of the Patriot Act, but they're charged under a statute that preexisted the Patriot Act on the basis of activity that preexisted the Patriot Act, on using surveillance that preexisted the Patriot Act. So I just don't see where the connection is. The caller asked about Patriot 2. Patriot 2 is a draft bill that was leaked by a disgruntled Justice Department employee in February 2003. And it sort of takes off where the Patriot Act stops and goes much, much further. What the Patriot Act did, it did a lot of things, but some of the more troubling things it did were to increase the government's ability to conduct surveillance on us, all of us, without probable cause of criminal activity, and in many instances without meaningful judicial review. What Patriot 2 would do would be to authorize for the first time in the U.S. Code secret arrests of both foreign nationals and U.S. citizens, to create a DNA database of suspected terrorists defined not by criminal conduct but by political affiliation, to presumptively strip even native-born U.S. citizens of their citizenship if they're found to have provided support to any group that the Attorney General or the Secretary of State has designated a terrorist organization without any need to show that the individual actually supported any terrorist activity of the group in question. So it's a very, very troubling proposal. It has not been introduced. It has not been introduced. I think that's significant. And in fact, when President Bush on September 10th gave a speech and said we need broader authorities to fight terrorism, and he endorsed three proposals. They were from Patriot 2, but they were only three out of about 60 provisions that were in the draft Patriot 2. And I think it's largely because the administration, not because the administration has suddenly become sensitive to civil rights, but civil liberties, but rather that it realizes it couldn't get Patriot 2 right now. That the American people and the members of Congress are sufficiently skeptical about the government's the expanded powers the government already has, that they are very unlikely right now to give them much more. And so he was not willing to seek all that they clearly were contemplating seeking.
All right. So if Patriot 2 is not coming out, is stifled, then what is the Bush administration and the Ashcroft Justice Department gonna try to do next? What powers are they gonna try to get next?
Right. Well, there, I wouldn't say it's stifled. I'd say it's still there on the back burner. And if there's another terrorist attack, I wouldn't be surprised if we see most of Patriot 2 introduced, the week after. But all I'm saying is that I think in part because there's been so much public education on issues about the civil liberties abuses that the administration has engaged in since 9/11, in part through these grassroots initiatives undertaken by the Bill of Rights Defense Committees and a group that was started in Massachusetts but now has led to over 180 local and state legislatures and councils adopting resolutions condemning the civil liberties abuses of the Patriot Act. In part because of that, the administration feels that it can't get what it would like. I mean, the fact that John Ashcroft went out on a national speaking tour to defend the Patriot Act itself suggests that the momentum is shifting here. When the Patriot Act was passed 6 weeks after 9/11, only one senator was willing to vote against it, Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. One senator was willing to vote against it. Today, every Democratic presidential candidate makes criticism of the Patriot Act a central part of their platform, including those who were senators and voted for it when it was enacted. There's been a massive shift in views on these issues. A Republican from Idaho, Butch Otter, introduced a bill to nullify one of the sneak and peek provision of the Patriot Act just a couple months ago, and it passed by a margin of nearly 200 votes in the House of Representatives. So they realize that they're on the defensive. You don't go out and launch a nationwide speaking tour in defense of a statute that everybody thinks is a great thing. You go out and defend it because you are on the defensive. So I think that right now they are somewhat constrained in what they can seek. Specifically what they're seeking right now are the authority to use administrative subpoenas in terrorism investigations, to have a presumption against bail in any terrorism case, and to expand more, to create more death penalties for terrorism cases. Each of those provisions has problems. The administrative subpoena provision is the worst problem from a civil liberties perspective, because what it would do is essentially allow the government to call anybody they want in for coercive compelled testimony without a grand jury to oversee the process. So, you know, right now, you know, we can all be called in if there's an ongoing criminal investigation, and if a grand jury authorizes a subpoena, we can be called in before the grand jury and we have to answer questions that are relevant to that investigation. But the prosecutor asks us those questions knowing that there are 23 of our citizens sitting behind him and watching over his shoulder. That's how the grand jury process works. This would take the grand jury out of the process altogether and give the prosecutor the ability to just sign a slip of paper, serve it on you, require you to come into his office, close the door, nobody's there, and then interrogate you, and you're compelled to answer the questions. That's a very, very different situation, I think one that is invites abuse. But that's one of the measures that they are now seeking, and that is very much on the table.
I want to thank the last caller, and I hope he wouldn't mind if I go on, because I've got somebody here who's on a cell phone who's been waiting patiently. I want to get them. This is a caller on line number two right here. Hello.
Hello. Good
yes.
morning.
Yes.
To take you back to Jose Padilla and the other American citizen, to your knowledge, has an American citizen ever been classified an enemy combatant before?
Uh-huh. Well, yes and no. There is a precedent. There are two precedents that the government cites, and they're both American citizens who were fighting for the other side during World War II. One came over with the Germans as a saboteur and snuck into the country and was part of a plan to sabotage defense facilities here.
Right.
And he was tried in a military tribunal. And he argued, well, I'm a U.S. citizen. I can't be tried in a military tribunal. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not right. If you're fighting for the enemy in a declared war, and you violate the laws of war, you can be tried in a military tribunal no matter what your citizenship is. And the other was a case involving a man who was fighting for the Italians, who was arrested and held as a prisoner of war and was a U.S. citizen, and the court said that, you know, even though he was a U.S. citizen, he could still be held as a prisoner of war if he was fighting for the other side. But here's the difference. We're holding Mr. Padilla and Mr. Hamdi. We are not giving them, we're not holding them as prisoners of war. To be held as a prisoner of war, you can't be held incommunicado, you can't be interrogated at length, you have a certain set of rights which we have denied to them altogether. We are not giving them a trial. They have not been tried before a military tribunal. In fact, the military tribunal rules that President Bush created apply only to non-citizens, so they couldn't be tried before a military tribunal. And instead, we're asserting the power, the unprecedented power, to hold them without charge, without trial, without access to anybody, incommunicado, indefinitely. And there are, you know, there are real questions as to whether these guys are, in fact, you know, connected to al-Qaeda, fighting with al-Qaeda, etc. I mean, the government claims that it picked up Yasser Hamdi on the battlefield in Afghanistan, but we've never heard from Mr. Hamdi. So for all we know, Mr. Hamdi could have been picked up at a, you know, mall in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and if the government, you know, and we would never know because the courts have never heard from Mr. Hamdi. Mr. Padilla, we know, was picked up at O'Hare Airport because his initial arrest was a public was public, and his initial detention as a material witness was public. But he's now been declared an enemy combatant. But we don't know whether the government's allegations that he was planning to figure out how to detonate a radiological bomb are true or not, because there's never been any kind of process by which Mr. Padilla could respond to those charges, could refute those charges. So the difference is that, you know, with the American who was fighting for the Italians, he didn't dispute that he'd been fighting for the Italians, and he was held as a prisoner of war, entitled to access and communication with his family, etc. And with the other man who was tried in World War II as a German saboteur, he was given a trial. These people are given no access to anybody, no trial whatsoever, and it's not obvious that they are, in fact, who the government says they are, because there's never been any process by which we could determine whether that's true.
Right. Now, one other question for you. Is there any limit on the president's power to classify people as enemy combatants?
Well, that's a great question, and I think, you know, that's what the courts are going to work out. The government's contention is, if the president declares you an enemy combatant, that's the end of the matter. All it has to do is file an affidavit saying that you're an enemy combatant, and the courts have to accept that affidavit. They're not allowed to look into whether the facts asserted in the affidavit are true or not. They're not allowed to hear from the detainee. The detainee is not allowed to participate in the proceeding that the courts engage in to assess the legality of the detention. So from the government, if the government's view is adopted by the courts, there will be no limits. That is, the president can declare any of us an enemy combatant at any time. Now, you know, will he use that in a broad way? I doubt it. But the real question is, you know, should we be giving the executive branch of the federal government this unchecked power and simply hope and trust that he won't abuse it? I don't think so. I think we can protect ourselves in much more by affording the president much more limited power, giving people some process by which to challenge their designation. I don't question the notion that the government has the power to hold people who are fighting a war against us for the duration of the war. And I think we're in a war with Al-Qaeda. And so if someone is an Al-Qaeda person, I think that person can be held as a prisoner of war. But you've got to provide some process by which people can challenge the claim, the assertion, that they are, in fact, an enemy combatant. And thus far, the government has refused to provide that process, both to the people on Guantanamo and to the people held in the United States.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Sure. Thank you. We're headed into our last 15 minutes. Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is David Cole. He is professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He is legal affairs correspondent for The Nation and commentator frequently on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. He's also a columnist for Legal Times. Here we're talking about issues of civil liberties and the war on terrorism, and we have talked some specifically about the way that under the rubric of the war on terrorism, we have treated non-citizens here in the United States, foreign nationals in the United States, and he's authored a book on this. It's titled Enemy Aliens, Double Standards, and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism, published by the New Press. We have a caller in Belgium, near Danville. That's the next person here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a question for your guest here. In that, don't you fear for your own safety? Because as we understood from his early speeches, the gentleman who occupies the White House has said anybody who speaks against him is a terrorist. So therefore, you are in this group also, sir. Also, how can we ever straighten this out since the Supreme Court actually helped put him in office, much against our chagrin, people who voted, seems to though the deck is stacked completely against us to get this thing turned around in a reasonable manner.
Well, you know, as to my concern for my own safety, I'd say, you know, it's true. The president said you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, and then John Ashcroft, of course, famously said those who would raise civil liberties concerns only aid terrorists and weaken our resolve. So both the president and the attorney general have essentially declared me and others like me to be traitors. But I think, you know, I'm not that concerned because my sense is that both of those statements were greeted with widespread criticism. I think there's a tremendous wealth of sort of reserve in this country of respect for the freedom to speak out, the freedom of dissent. I consider it, my patriotic duty to speak out when I see our government violating the very principles that make our nation the great nation that it is. So So I don't, you know, I don't fear say, and I, you know, and I think also, you know, when I did my did my research for this book, the enemy, my new book, the Enemy Aliens book, one of the things that struck me was that we have made a lot of progress on speech issues. I mean, during World War I, people were thrown in jail for merely saying that they were opposed to the draft. In the McCarthy era, people were thrown in jail for advocating communist ideas, for having books about communism in their libraries, for their political beliefs. In the civil rights era, groups were subject to infiltration and dirty tricks and surveillance from the FBI based on their politics, if they were anti-war groups, if they were civil rights groups, etc. I think today there's a, in part because of those experiences, there's a much more healthy respect for freedom of speech, and the government has not, you know, directly attacked people like myself who have criticized their efforts. They've certainly tried to call our loyalty into question, but I think that has backfired more than it has actually succeeded. You know, on the other hand, I do fear for my safety in terms of the terrorists. I mean, I do think that there is a real threat of terrorism that we face. I don't want to in any way minimize that, the reality of that threat. But my concern is that the measures that we have taken have not made us safer. In fact, they've made us less secure, because one of the consequences of these kind of double standards that we've employed, where we've imposed on foreign nationals, and especially Arabs and Muslims, burdens and obligations that we wouldn't be willing to bear ourselves, is that we have contributed to this incredible anti-American resentment around the world. You know, on 9/11, there was one group that hated us and was willing to do incredible damage to us. But the world, you know, on 9/12, you know, gave us their sympathy. Today, 2 years later, those who hate us are much broader than Al-Qaeda. And we have created a situation in which there is a greater degree of anti-Americanism around the world than ever before in this country's history. That cannot be a good thing for the security of our country. So, you know, my concern about safety is concerned that we are making the world a more fertile breeding ground for terrorists by virtue of the kinds of unprincipled measures that we have adopted in response to the very real threat of terrorism.
Well, as Mr. Inge's people have said at different times, there is a definition of what terrorism is here in this decision, because some of these people look at themselves very much as their own patriots for their own countries and their own beliefs. They're just trying to fight for what they desire, because as you said, we have made enemies all over this world by our actions. Just like our dear president said when he flew into some aircraft carrier, he said, "We won the war." Well, yesterday, he backpedaled and said, "Well, that's not what I meant. We meant something else." We can't trust this gentleman, and he's just causing more and more problems for us by this war in Iraq and the shenanigans he's playing in any other place in the world.
Well, right, and your question was, what can we do about it? I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we can do is to educate, to organize, to support those who support civil liberties. And you know, as I mentioned before, I think this grassroots effort to get local towns to adopt ordinances that condemn not the entire Patriot Act, but the civil liberties abuses within the Patriot Act, has been a tremendous organizing and educational opportunity, and I think has played a significant role in shifting the sort of public concern towards a much greater concern for civil liberties. And you know, and you now see all the Democratic presidential candidates criticizing John Ashcroft, criticizing the civil liberties abuses of the Patriot Act, you know, wanting to make sure that we have a country that is secure from terrorism, of course, but wanting to do so in a way that is smart, that is principled, that is, you know, that honors the traditions of our nation. And I think by supporting those individuals, and by supporting the efforts of groups like the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the ACLU to educate people about the threats that we face here, I think there is a possibility of turning this around. And I think, as I suggested before, the momentum has shifted, as is, you know, illustrated by John Ashcroft's very defensive national tour.
We have about 10 minutes left. Again, we have other callers. The next is Bloomington, Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm concerned about abridgments of due process of law, but when I look at the realities we face, I don't see much alternative to the Patriot Act. The realities we face is that we have a core of religious fanatics who are willing to die. They're willing to commit suicide in order to murder as many Americans as they possibly can. And there's really no way to stop those people from getting into the United States. Trying to guard our aircraft, it's been demonstrated how easy it is to get box cutters on aircraft, how easy it is to get weapons on air. You can't stop that. And so the way that we have chosen, and apparently the only way that works, it has worked since November 11th, is to discover all of the people, all of those fanatics that we can, that are willing to commit suicide to murder Americans, and imprison them. Put them out of circulation, and that has worked so far. And how many lives it has saved? Good grief! At least they haven't attacked us yet. They haven't been able to attack us again since November 11th. That strategy apparently is working. It is apparently required the Patriot Act. It's requiring some people to be imprisoned that probably shouldn't be, admittedly, and that's disturbing. But you know, American lives are at stake, and there are people who are willing to commit suicide to murder us.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right that American lives are at stake, and there are people who are willing to commit suicide to murder us. I don't think that the evidence shows that the Patriot Act has worked. I mean, what I laid out before, the numbers that 5,000 people have been locked up, only one person convicted of anything related to terrorism. The vast majority, virtually all of the rest of those 5,000, not only not convicted or charged with anything related to terrorism, but affirmatively cleared by the FBI of any connection to terrorism. So I failed to see how locking up several thousand people who have no connection to terrorism makes us safer. If you ask how many Al-Qaeda foreign nationals has the United States, has John Ashcroft and the domestic efforts identified, the answer is zero. You know, the only person who has actually been charged as Al-Qaeda, et cetera, was Mr. Moussaoui, and he was picked up, as I said before this whole campaign began. So this, you know, the ethnic profilings, requiring 80,000 Arabs and Muslims to register, interviewing 8,000 Arab and Muslim males by the FBI, prioritizing the deportations of foreign nationals simply because they've come from Arab and Muslim countries, detaining Arabs and Muslims, has resulted in the identification of zero Al-Qaeda people, of zero people involved in 9/11, and of only one person convicted of any kind of terrorist activity whatsoever, and that was a conviction for support, providing conspiracy to provide support to some unspecified terrorist act in the unspecified future. So I just don't see the evidence that the domestic efforts have actually contributed to our safety. I do see, however, that they have contributed to this rising tide of anti-Americanism around the world, which I think is the biggest threat to our security, because it means that there are going to be more people out there who are willing to commit suicide to attack us. Now, I distinguish that from the military activities abroad. I mean, I think going over and attacking Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan did a lot of good in terms of putting Al-Qaeda out of, you know, taking away its base of operations, closing all of its training camps, killing many of its members, capturing all kinds of information about its organizational structure. We have detained many high-level Al-Qaeda people abroad, but none of that is by virtue of the Patriot Act or the domestic campaign. So I think it's a mistake to think that because we passed the Patriot Act and there hasn't been a terrorist attack in the last 2 years, that there's necessarily a causal relation there. I think you'd have to show that there's actually been some sort of arrest or there's been some sort of detention of someone who is actually planning to do something here before you could even make that claim, and the evidence shows quite the contrary.
Well, you make some good points, and I think we should continue to have a rigorous debate on this. You make some really good points, and we got to defend freedom. We got to keep people from getting murdered, but we also have to defend freedom.
Absolutely, it's a tough balance.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. I want to try to get at least one more. We'll go to Chicago here, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Wasn't it Benjamin Franklin said that if you sacrificed freedom in order to have security, you're worthy of neither?
It was.
Yeah. But my question is using their logic and their premise, how in the, by the wildest scheme of anybody's imagination, does all this secrecy, all this depriving of any type of rights of order whatsoever, how in the world does that process make things more secure?
Well, you know, I mean, secrecy is a complicated issue because, of course, there are legitimate reasons for maintaining secrecy of certain kinds of activities. Surveillance operations, generally, you don't want to make them public because the people who are being surveilled will alter their behavior in such an extent that you're not able to discover the illegal activities that you're undergoing. But so there are legitimate reasons for secrecy. This administration, however, has taken secrecy to an extreme and has invoked secrecy where there are no good reasons for it. And it seems to be relying on secrecy not so much to keep Al-Qaeda, you know, from learning important information or secrets, but to keep the American people from having information that might reflect poorly on the administration. So, for example, the government not only arrested all of these individuals after 9/11 in secret, but also for all those who were held on immigration charges, they were tried in secret. Their trials were closed to the public, to the press, to legal observers, even to family members. And in not one of these hundreds and hundreds of cases that were closed, entirely tried in secret, in not one of those cases did the government introduce any classified information. So there was no sensitive information introduced in any of those trials that required classification. And if you're familiar with classification procedures, they're extremely overbroad. So if there's any concern whatsoever, material gets classified. Yet these cases didn't involve any sensitive information, and nonetheless, the government tried every single one of them in secret, no matter how routine the charges. That kind of secrecy, it seems to me, serves this other goal of keeping the public from seeing what the government is doing, because if those trials had been public, then the government would have seen what we now know to be true, but didn't know at the time, that literally not one of these people who was picked up on an immigration charge after 9/11 was charged with anything related to terrorism, had any connection to terrorism. And yet, these are the people who John Ashcroft was trumpeting as the terrorist suspects that they were arresting in ever increasing numbers in the days and weeks after 9/11. So the secrecy there was used to hide information that would have been embarrassing to the government, and that is not a legitimate use of secrecy.
We are going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. We want to again suggest, if you're interested in reading more on the subject, you look for the book that we've been talking about here. It's titled Enemy Aliens by our guest David Coles, published by the New Press. David Cole is professor at the Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Cole, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.